Kiss, I Tell. My name's Sarah Hall and I'm a Deputy Director at UK in a Changing Europe. I'm delighted to be joining Anand in hosting some of our upcoming episodes of You Kiss, I Tell, starting with today's conversation with Sundar Katwala, Director of British Future. I really hope you enjoy it. So today I'm really happy to welcome Sundar Katwala to the You Kiss, I Tell podcast. Sundar, as I'm sure many listeners will know, is the director of British Future, a think tank based in London that seeks to understand public attitudes in the area of integration, immigration, identity and race to foster a more inclusive Britain. Sundar previously worked at The Observer, and as a General Secretary of the Fabian Society, he established British Future as a non-partisan think tank that engages across the political spectrum to understand what he terms the anxious middle, referring to those who are neither wholly pro nor anti-immigration. And on that theme, Sundar has just written a book, How to Be a Patriot, Why Love of Country Can End Our Very British Culture War. So Sundar, could you start by just giving us an idea of some of the main arguments that you make in that book?
Yes, it's a very personal book because it's about me, my understanding of identity, how that was shaped by my own background and how that influences the approach I take to what are quite a set of contested and polarised issues about identity in Britain. Today, I was born British to parents who came to this country from India and from Ireland met through the National Health Service. And so I grew up sort of mixed ethnic heritage, Irish Catholic, really, because my mum's faith was stronger than my dad's Hindu faith. This is the mid-70s when I'm born, went to school in the 1980s, went to university in the 1990s, and felt pretty confident, I think, that Britain was opening up for people like me, that Britain was having an identity that was more inclusive, more confident about the ethnic and faith diversity of Britain that had clearly been, you know, a big part of our society, you know, for three decades before I was born in the post-Windrush era. But in this century, things have got much choppier, more polarised. So I take that personal sense, that experience for me of things opening up, becoming more inclusive, and try and look into the themes of history and identity after empire, what do we do with statues, Brexit, what happened there, immigration, race, faith, what we're doing about that, the so-called culture wars, and try and work out what's going on and how we navigate through them. And the argument is that while identity obviously can divide us down the middle on questions like Brexit or Scottish independence, we've got to engage with, grapple with identity and find the way to manage difference, agree to disagree about difference, work out what the common ground is of a shared identity and the political arguments about the future. And that we're still a country that can do that, although it feels in some ways to be getting more heated and more polarised and more difficult.
And that, yeah, I mean, as you say, the book sort of in some ways charts your kind of growing up in the UK. What do you see as some of the major differences between kind of growing up in the 80s and 90s, I think it was in the southeast, and the sort of state of the debate now?
Yes, I mean, the two big differences I saw and I experienced that I'm pretty confident are going to hold is if you know, I was going to school in the 1980s, I moved from Cheshire, the sort of Merseyside side of Cheshire, to Essex when I was 13. But I was a big football fan, and I was very keen to be taken to see real football matches when I was 7, 8, 9, or 10. There was a level of overt racism in football stadiums in the mid-80s, the late-80s, the early-90s, that receded from the mid-1990s. And it was a very big cultural shift at club level, at international level. You know, what the culture of going to an England match was incredibly different by the late 1990s than it would have been beforehand. But that was symbolic of the level of tolerance for overt racism overt prejudice in society, whether racist jokes were banter or whether they were racism. And then secondly, I graduated from university in 1995, going out into the world of the very late 90s, the early 21st century. There was very little presence, and people forget this now, of Black, Asian, mixed race people in our public life. It's coming through in the 1990s. But I graduated from university. There'd never been an Asian or Black government minister in this country. There were, when I cast my first vote, 6 out of 650 visible minority members of parliament. So this normality of diversity in national politics especially, but public and professional life more generally, I saw that happening really in the early years of this century. And those are big, significant changes that relate to a change of expectations across the generations that I think we'll hold on to, but also create something of a polarisation between generations as to what our expectations, what our aspirations are for how fast we need to go further.
That's really interesting. I'd like to pick up on both of those two big arguments. And the first one's about sport. So I think from reading the book, I can tell you're a big football fan, but you use football and sport more generally as a kind of way of trying to think about how things have changed. And I just wondered, you know, is that distinctly a sort of British thing that we can use sport to think about this? And why do you think it's a valuable way of approaching these issues?
I think it happens in all countries. I mean, the thing that occurred to me is, you know, by the time I was 15 or 16, I had theories about national identity, ideas about national identity, maybe a bit earlier than some people would, because it sort of opens, you know, like, do you count as British Sunder? Do you count as English? Is it a question people are asking you? But I've already got 6, 7, 8, 9 years of experience of national identity through engaging with things like sporting contests. It could, you know, you don't have to be in sport. It could be the Eurovision Song Contest. It could be, you know, how royal occasions are marked, you know, at nursery, at primary school, at secondary school. So we all have experience of national identity feeling welcoming, inclusive, exclusive, about somebody else, not really about you, stretching to involve you, depending on your ethnic background, your faith background, your class background. We all have that experience in, you know, as primary school children, before we start to talk about identity in secondary school, at university, and so on. I think that really matters when you're making speeches about what is national identity, what are shared values, that people already have some experience as to what feels open and what feels closed. I think if you think about all advanced Western democracies really having to grapple with this challenge of, is there a civic and inclusive national identity? Was there more of an ethnic identity before, and is that changing, and does that feel like it's changed to the minority groups and to the majority group? Everybody has achieved that in terms of the 11 people that represent them on a football pitch. If you say, you know, if you look at who's playing for Switzerland or who's playing for Germany or who's playing for England, the sort of diversity of the younger group, the 20-somethings, is on the pitch, whether we're talking about, you know, men's or women's football these days. But whether that is then a separate sphere of society, or whether that reflects a broader understanding that, you know, somebody who's Italian with Black parents from Ghana is just as Italian as other people who are Italian. That is something we've got to work on. But sport is unusual these days. Not the only thing, but you know, big cultural events still there, big royal events in countries that have got a monarchy, when we have a very fragmented public space, when we can all have individual choice about what to stream, when, what to watch, when, what to listen to, when different to, you know, we were watching fewer channels when I was growing up. Sporting events are still a moment when 10, 15, 20 million people might be watching the same thing at the same time. And so it's a natural point when the who do we think we are conversation is in every living room, not just in the universities or in the pressure groups or civic society groups.
That's really interesting. And then your kind of second big argument that you raised was the kind of presence of Asian and Black members of society holding sort of the key offices of public state, if you like. What difference do you think that's made, and how? I guess one thing that I'm quite interested in is how that intersects with questions of class, and whether, you know, that's kind of moving in the direction of greater homogeneity, or if you think there's kind of room for further improvement there.
I mean, my perception is very clear. I think it's obvious that we've made more progress on gender equality and on equality across ethnic groups than we have on social class equality in public life and in professions. Broadly speaking, in that period, at the end of the 90s, the start of this century, public life in particular, which is symbolic because we elect people to represent all of us, became more open to women, more open to Black and Asian people who had the educational and professional credentials of the existing elite. But it was harder, I think, to work out something that was changing in a different way, how those professional educational credentials would, how you would open up across social class backgrounds to people who didn't go on the same educational upward mobility journey. So I think there is a challenge about how that works. It can only happen if, you know, happen relatively easy with gender in this sense that, you know, while there were big exclusions and barriers, it wasn't the case, I think, once women were in public life, that people were really asking, can women represent women as well as men? Or do men represent men and women just speak for women? It helps, I think, if it's a sort of broadly 50-50 group to see that, you know, women can represent political views and can represent a constituency just as well as men can. If you get over certain prejudices about, you know, should women go out to work when they're married? The question of, you know, is a Black MP in Parliament to represent, to be a tribune of the Black community, and therefore they should represent a Black area and bring that perspective in so we don't miss that perspective out? Or are they an everybody representative of any constituency? I think that was a more contested and complicated question. You can become an MP for both reasons, but you can't actually become the Home Secretary or the Chancellor of the Exchequer or the Prime Minister unless we've decided that the everybody representation is possible by people of different ethnic and faith background. Britain's, I think, just gone a bit further, a bit faster in saying that's normal. Don't even notice that. We're doing it so often we don't even notice it. Britain has believed that for about 3 or 4 years. But it's interesting that it's a very new thing not to notice. There were no Asian women in our parliament till 2010. There'd never been an Asian Secretary of State until Sajid Javid was the Culture Secretary in 2014. So it's really remarkable pace of change that you see so many prime ministers, Home Secretaries, Chancellor of the Exchequer, Scottish First Ministers, and everyone's saying, well, who would back an eyelid? Why would we even notice that has happened? That really wasn't possible in the 1990s.
So that's quite a sort of optimistic story. In the book, you also talk about how divisions have been exacerbated or kind of developed in more recent years. And one of the issues you raise is Brexit. So, you know, has Brexit made these matters worse?
Brexit has made Britain realise something that must have been true before Brexit, which is that we're more anxious, fragmented and divided society than we had thought of ourselves as being. And then the question of whether to stay in or leave the European Union, which is a sort of ongoing debate in British politics for sort of 40, 50, 60 years about the common market and joining it and not joining it and Euroscepticism, sort of becomes this moment when the big identity debates are going to get joined up in some way, it feels to a lot of people, and that we're having some kind of open versus closed debate, some kind of future versus the past debate. And I think that's a slightly odd thing to do with the question of European membership in Britain, which is one of 4 or 5 big separate identity crises that is bubbling under from the 1970s and the 1990s. You've also got the question of the nations of the UK. You've got the questions of immigration and multiculturalism, the question of faith. And the European question isn't a particularly good proxy for a lot of those questions. But having that referendum in or out in 2016 becomes a kind of a big moment. Something interesting happens in 2016, which is that the country is much, much more divided over that question, that referendum in 2019. Than it is in 2016. In 2016, I think 2/4 of society think this is a really big stakes debate and we really must stay in or we really must leave. And a lot of other people are thinking, gosh, the Prime Minister's asked me a very difficult question here. I wonder which way I'm going to jump. And, you know, in some of the research here on polling day, on referendum day, 4 out of 10 people say they made their minds up that month which way to jump. Seeing, you know, some of the arguments on both sides. 3 years later, 9 out of 10 people identify with the vote that they cast in 2016, because we have a stalemate in which there are two parallel camps. There are new identities, there are new affiliations, there are Remainers and Leavers, and they stand for what's wrong with the people who didn't agree with me. Why, if 52% of us voted for something, are they still asking why it could happen? I told you they were arrogant snobs that weren't democratic at all. Or why, when it's much more complicated than they thought, are they still steaming ahead and not listening to the difficulties? I told you they didn't care at all about the reality, and so on. And so that I think became a really dangerous moment, I think, for British political culture, where I think we're taking a step towards something I don't want to import, which is an American politics where almost everything lines up with each other. If I see you wearing a face mask on the train, I can guess how you voted, and I think I know your views of climate change as well. That is a very polarized politics to get into. I think in the 2017 and 2019 elections, and the voting by geography, by class, by age, all becoming more polarized, I think we saw British politics looking in that direction of a more sort of binary politics.
Hello, sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to remind you to sign up to the UK in a Changing Europe newsletter, which comes out every week, featuring our latest research and news about our exciting range of events. Subscribe now on our website. Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions, actually, around the extent to which you think there are similarities or differences between the kinds of debates we're having here in the UK and the Black Lives Matter movement that originated in the US. I was just wondering how you felt those ideas travelled and translated as they move.
I think Britain's just a very different society from America, and more different than perhaps we realise. And then in a sort of internet age, in an instant communications age, I think the debates get joined up a lot more. And I think it is difficult on both the left and the right if we take in too much debate from America. I mean, America, because of its size, because of, you know, much higher level of religious faith, because of specific ways that issues play out about guns, about abortion, there's a much more deeper polarization that is going on. And this to some extent is why, you know, even something like a pandemic turns out to have partisan polarization in the US, and it doesn't in the UK. Britain is much more polarized than expected to be over questions like Brexit, questions like Scotland, maybe questions about statues, but there's more common ground there if you want to find it. If we adopt a more American political culture, then we might find it harder to have the common ground. On race, it's a really interesting thing if you go around and talk to people. I talked to a lot of people after the Black Lives Matter protests. There was a lot of common ground, really, that Britain's very different from America among people who were very supportive of those protests. And then what young people were saying who were supportive of the protests are, it's very different from America if you think about policing and violence and guns. It's just, it's not the same at all, although we've got solidarity to what happened to George Floyd. But I don't like this argument that it's different from America, because then I think people are trying to use that to close down the argument about what needs to change here. We're making the point that more change is needed here. This is a domestic argument. And then people on the other side will be saying, well, why are you using the same slogans or so on? But the British debate was different. It was about statues of Edward Colston. It was about post-imperial identity. The Black British experience is different from the Black American experience. I mean, because it's a 4% group, not a 13% group, it has a different social context. It is much more culturally, socially integrated into society in the big cities, particularly in London, much, much higher levels of intermarriage. That gives you a different Black British identity than a Black American identity. It gives you a different multi-ethnic debate in Britain. Social relationships between different ethnic groups are closer in Britain, particularly among the young. And so that's where I just like to, you know, think about what's happening in America, but maybe make different choices, because there you've got a sort of red on blue polarisation that's tit for tat both ways round. And it is getting harder and harder, I think, for anybody to bridge those divides.
And kind of following on, I guess one of the things that people might often try and do is make a distinction between nationalism and patriotism. And so given the title of your book, you know, assuming you think there is a distinction, what do those two terms mean to you?
Yeah, a lot of ink has been spilt on different distinctions. It might be nationalism versus patriotism. It might be civic patriotism versus ethnic identity, and so on. These are important distinctions to get right, because the kind of shared citizenship, shared national identity you want in a diverse society is one that can belong to anybody who is a citizen of that country, feels that it's home. So it's an important distinction to get right. It can be a slightly crude sort of nationalism bad, patriotism good. You've got to interrogate what's happening. What I want to challenge a little bit among the liberal side of this debate that wants the inclusive civic version is there can then be a tendency to say, because all countries have to do this and we're all very different, the way we make it inclusive is just to take as much out as possible. And what we need to demand is the rule of law. And that if you start demanding anything that's a bit more emotional or cultural or historical than the rule of law, you'll start to exclude people. I think that's a mistake. I think you have to take out the ethnic status example, but you can leave in, I think, all of the shared cultural experiences of being Scottish, Welsh, English, British, if you make it inclusive. I don't think, you know, Shakespeare is exclusive to people of one ethnicity or another. And if you make it open to challenge, so, you know, we can talk about the history of migration, race and empire, and that's why we're British. Oh, that's why we've got the Britain we've got today. You know, my parents are from India and Ireland. I'm British for a reason. You've got to be able to contest it, not to replace one set of myths with another set of myths, but just to try and broaden. I think you have these very polarised debates if people feel that the broadening is removing, taking things away. If you're saying, write all the stories in, write all of the chapters into the book, it becomes harder for people, I think, to object and to say, we've just got to keep it as it was.
And I guess one thing that's interesting about kind of national identities is that they're clearly formed from a whole range of inputs. But when we think particularly about Britishness, you know, there are arguments that they're dominated by kind of English symbolism, so the Magna Carta, Crown and Parliament, sovereignty. And I just wondered how that can then be moved, or whether you think it's possible to generate a form of Britishness that speaks to patriotism across the different constituent nations within the UK.
There's certainly a challenge there. I mean, one of the things that perhaps made British identity more open to ethnic and faith pluralism in the last 75 years since Windrush was that it had 300 years since the Union of being multinational and to some extent multicultural in the relationship between Scotland and Wales and so on. What the English British were less clear at making the distinction than the Welsh British or the Scottish British between national identities and the shared civic identity of a multinational state. And in the last 25, 30 years, it's much more consciously multinational. So people think, well, that will be more difficult. But in that sense, the English have now got a better appreciation, I think, of what the Scottish and Welsh already knew, which is that, funnily enough, it's not just ethnic and faith minorities. Most people in Britain identify with more than one flag and more than one national identity. And one argument about patriotism and nationalism says to every nation a state. You know, if you really think you're Scottish and Welsh, get your state. That's the only way to do it. And another thing says actually you can have multinational polities and identities. It's hard to do it if it becomes so siloed, and this will be a challenge, I think, for the United Kingdom in the next decade. If when we have a general election, we're really having four or five different general elections in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, you know, the Red Wall, the Blue Wall, and London, and those are just, you know, the actual national, the UK-wide election doesn't really exist. It's just an aggregation of the results, and there are different party systems. Then you haven't got a shared discussion about what it means. So getting that balance right is important. To some extent, it might feel that the monarchy is too English and the monarchy needs to work across the nations and the generations. To another extent, it's Englishness that hasn't really got a space or a voice in these debates, apart from having a football team and a cricket team. So you know, you might have to work more on understanding what is the English element of a multinational UK, as well as the Scottish and Welsh element that have been now institutionalised with devolution.
And I guess one of the kind of the big issues that the UK is grappling with at the moment is the question of immigration. So this is obviously central within the Brexit vote. And then I think we've seen quite interesting developments where rates of immigration have increased quite substantially from a number of different reasons. And at the same time, kind of public opinion on immigration has changed. I wondered if you could unpack that a bit from your kind of thinking around patriotism and what you think this might suggest.
So we've certainly seen a decade of two halves in immigration attitudes. And, there's a long history in the Powell era and the end of Commonwealth free movement, and then the debates about European free movement and Brexit. This often recurred. One of the reasons we had the referendum, and one of the reasons we had a 52% leave vote, was that governments had lost confidence under New Labour and under David Cameron that they were managing the pace and scale of immigration well. Doesn't necessarily mean that people are hostile to Polish people who come to Britain, but there was a lack of confidence in governments. Brexit happens eventually, the 2019 election sees that implemented and the immigration system changes. And immigration stays very high because actually the government chooses to liberalise non-EU immigration post-study leave, a new visa for Hong Kongers because of what's happened there. And so we see higher immigration, more diverse immigration, as well as the end of European free movement. And attitudes become more confident, partly because of a long-term generational shift, but also because of a sense of control, choice, and selection. We're now having another debate. The numbers are very high this year. Net 600,000 is absolutely record number. Some of that is about the Ukraine visas, which almost everybody agreed on. Some of it's about the Hong Kong policy, which has a broad consensus. So these are now the dilemmas of control. One way to have that debate about the dilemmas of control is, do you want to give a visa to someone to study, to stay after they study or to work in the NHS? Will it be good or bad to let this person come to Britain? And attitudes are quite pragmatic about how to use controls. But I want to go beyond that, who is good for us, who do we let in, to what happens afterwards. And so where I bring my inclusive patriotism frame in says, are they good for us? You can win the argument for student migration and fruit picking and social care and health, and it's less one size fits all. What really gives you confidence in immigration and integration over time is people becoming us, that we encourage and welcome people to become British if they want to. We think it's important that the children of migrants, whatever their background, have equal opportunities in education and jobs, but also have equal status in our national life. If you can get that right, I think you have sustained long-term consent for immigration, not on a basis that is quite transactional, come and work in the NHS, but on the basis that our society handles this well when it's fair to incomers and fair and good for the people they joined.
Yeah, it's really clear in the book and your writing more generally that you're kind of really interested in the questions of sort of what happens after immigration. Why do you think it is that sort of our politics and our media then sort of still seems focused on numbers and potentially reducing immigration?
I think there's some muscle memory in the debate, because we've been having an immigration debate since the 70s, since the 80s, since nice. Certainly in 2014, it was very high. And so, the principal politicians now and their advisors have grown up in that era. So I think they're slightly behind a shift in attitudes. The shift in attitudes, which is basically quite a lot of openness, if it's controlled openness, managed openness, chosen openness, and I've got a voice in it. That doesn't apply to what we're seeing in the Channel crossings, a much more polarized debate, because there's a visible lack of control and a visible lack of compassion. So you get a very polarized debate about that. So you've got to apply this sense of, can you have control and compassion there? But also what it turned out, I think, after Brexit with the free movement system is that instead of a yes or no debate or an open or closed debate, it turned out there was a lot of consent on who to give a visa for. That there was a broad agreement that, students are good, post-study leave is good, NHS visas are good, and so on. And so the immigration the public wants adds up to quite a lot. There's latent consent for this integration in inclusion citizenship debate, but it's not top of mind, it's not top of the in tray. So it's a big challenge for people like me. If there's a pandemic going on and there's economic pressures and so on, are people going to get onto the things that really give people confidence in immigration? Did we invest well in English language? Did we make contact happen earlier? Our society is quite good at integration, with a lag effect of a generation. We do less in Britain than they do perhaps in Germany, where there's been a later decision to welcome citizenship and to encourage it. There's been more proactive federal and state government about how you make that happen. I think maybe Britain coasts a bit in policy terms because the society gets there in the end, in the classrooms a generation later.
And, you know, if we see this, and I'm, obviously we don't know that this sort of really kind of exceptionally high numbers will continue, given some of the unique factors that are playing into that. But it does seem like there's a strong case for increased immigration. What implications do you think that might have for our politics and our public debate around Britishness?
Yeah, I think the exceptional numbers will fall because the Ukraine Hong Kong situations were exceptional. But we've now had two decades of net 250 averaging under two different governments, including a government that was trying to cut it. So the idea that there's some normal number that's half that from 1991 or something starts to look implausible. So you can make this work if you handle it fairly and opportunities and so on. You've got to think about housing. Housing's where there's a real pressure. If you're going to have sustained high migration, you've got to deal with the housing demands. I think it's important to go back to the thing that I said gave us confidence for the second generation of Britain's Commonwealth parents. We saw Britain open up for us and make that work. Will that happen for the 3 or 4 million people in this country with settled permanent status but not citizenship from Europe, to the children who are born here? Will Britishness and Britain feel as open to them? I think, you know, we can make that happen if we work at it. I think politically, the Conservative Party suffered a very long headache with its relationship with the first generation of Commonwealth migrants, transmitted itself across a couple of generations. And the Conservative Party is trying to change that now with its diversity. I think all the parties should be thinking about what it means to be a Hong Konger coming to Britain and the children growing up here, what it means to be a European with settled status. And we just want to, I think, what a good vision of inclusion and integration is, that, you know, within one generation, your parental background isn't affecting your opportunity in jobs and education, but nor is it affecting your status and presence. So I hope we'll see that reflected in public life, which is good for symbolism, but it's also good practically, really, that those different perspectives, those bridging perspectives of how that happens in the real world, you know, are in the parliament, are in the decision-making forums.
And do you have views on any challenges that might be posed to that model by the sort of geographical variation that we see in immigration, with, you know, some towns in Lincolnshire being like really focused on particular economies and particular migrant labour markets?
Yes, I think if you want to make it work, you've got to broaden the geography of confidence in it working. And, it'd be bad, for example, if universities just grew in the core cities and then felt distant from the towns 15 or 20 miles away from those core cities. I would like to see universities, you know, very much bridging those divides. I think one aspect of post-2004 and the Hong Konger migration is different. It's going to the suburbs, it's going to new places, is you've got more contact with diversity everywhere over time. And that can be difficult in the first instance, but over time it brings more contact and more confidence. So the most scepticism is in places of high and rapid change as it's happening for the first time, but also right out on the coast in the areas of the lower diversity, because people are watching the news, but they're not having the experience of contact. So I think more diversity can help. One challenge, I think, to the British model is that I think the British model makes a lot of sense and the British discourse makes a lot of sense, particularly for ethnic minorities from a Commonwealth background. And I'm not sure if it's quite as well adapted, really, or if it will necessarily extend when there's a broader range of migration into Britain. So in that sense, I think we can be a little bit complacent about a true story that we've actually handled this pretty well in the long term, despite all of the politics, if we're not actively checking that openness works. There's quite a, you know, I express it myself, with parents from India and Ireland, but if you think about what happens with the Windrush generation, they're told they're British, they come as British citizens, they arrive in London and Birmingham, and the stories that are told in the classrooms in Jamaica haven't been taught in England, so they're rejected, really. And their reaction to the rejection in that generation, across generations, is to double down on their stake to Britishness and really say to other people, you should know your history. If you don't know I'm British, the problem isn't with me, it's you not knowing your history. It's quite unusual for migrant groups, minority communities, to have that level of confidence in staking the claim to the overall national identity. But that I think is a distinctive part of the British story. It reflects the fuzziness, in a way, of Britain and the way in which, in a way, a post-imperial identity has managed to be perhaps counterintuitively more open. We'll have to work harder at making that true, whatever your background is, I think.
That's really interesting about kind of what the future might hold in terms of kind of debates around patriotism in the UK going forward. Thanks very much, Sundar, for giving up your time. And it goes without saying that I'd urge everyone to buy the book. I believe it's available at all good bookshops now.
Thanks very much.